This is Common Ground, a program on world affairs and the people who shape events. This week we continue our conversation with peace researcher Johan Galtung.
I could take a ridiculously simple example. I could say at the University of Hawaii, where I'm teaching a little bit, one guy was running to become president of the student union. Now, what was the propaganda for him? The propaganda was that he could see both sides of an issue. Now, both. Now you have two again. Now, who says there are only two sides to an issue? It could be 15, for instance.
Common Ground is produced by the Stanley Foundation. I'm Mary Gray Davidson. Norwegian Johan Galtung has spent a lifetime studying conflict and how to resolve it. He founded the International Peace Research Institute in Oslo and started the prestigious Journal of Peace Research. He's consulted with the United Nations on a broad range of issues and served as a conflict resolution facilitator between North and South Korea and Israel and Palestine. In the second part of our conversation, I began by asking Dr. Galtung if he finds any commonalities between all of the conflicts that he works on.
Oh, yes. That's why we have a conflict theory. It's called theory of conflict. It's about that. And you see, this is a little bit where mathematics enters it, because mathematics is about structures, and you see structures. Let me give an example. When I ask American college students, you have a conflict, how do you settle it? They invariably seem to come up with two solutions. Point one, hey, let's sit down and talk it over and arrive at a compromise. Point two, fight it out. Now, in a scheme I had, at least 14 different solutions. And I'll not go into that. I'll only say it's a very poor conflict solution repertory. As long as you can sit down and talk it over and get a compromise, it's fine. Americans are good at that, as long as they can. But you see, that only holds in the U.S. as long as you feel you're members of the same team, that you are part of the solution, not part of the problem. Both sides, or all three sides, or four sides, or 15 sides, are good team workers, to use Americanisms. And as long as you share something which I call the American smile. And the American smile is very sweet, but the flip side to it is that if the conflict is so serious that you don't smile any longer, then Americans become almost the most violent people in the world. If you're not in it, you're outside. And that holds internationally, nationally, and inside the family. There's enormous violence in the American family. It's very much what happens when the smile breaks down, and the tears and the strong words and the fisticuffs come out. And then it gets worse and worse. So there's a structure. There is something. So that is one civilization's look at conflict.
And that's more that bipolar thinking.
It's much more than that.
It's either or.
Oh. Well, the bipolar thinking comes into it. First of all, there are two ways of handling a problem. Secondly, there are two parties to it. And the compromise is usually seen as some sort of 50-50 solution. It's very simplistic. It's almost a kindergarten way of looking at conflict. If you will, you can take U.S. foreign policy and look at it from that point of view. Let us say that the U.S. had had a smiling relation to clients with famous names like Muhammad Aidid, who was used by the U.S., Manuel Noriega, who was attempted used against the Sandinistas, and maybe for drug control purposes, maybe not, against Saddam Hussein, who was used against Iran. And suddenly all three of them stop smiling one way or the other. The conflict piles up. Well, then I would predict that extreme violence will come very quickly. Because there's nothing the U.S. can take less than a client who has gone sour. So when that condition happens, you will have the Marines moving fairly quickly. Now, from that, you can draw two conclusions. A, don't be a client of the United States, because the U.S. has a quite interesting respect for non-clients, like a Castro. Castro was never treated by the Marines the way Noriega was treated, because Castro was never a client. Or, if you are a client, remain a client till you drop dead. If that's what you want, go ahead.
So can you give me an example of some alternative ways of looking at a conflict, of either you're with us or you're not?
You do. First of all, you simply say something which is, for instance, quite important in Buddhist theory of conflict, which is the idea, which I think is exaggerated by Buddhists, but nobody's guilty, nobody's non-guilty. But we have a bad karma. Now, the definition of karma, I once saw, obviously written by an American, it's the best definition I've seen, the simplest one, on the Berlin Wall, as a graffiti. Whatever you say, whatever you do, sooner or later comes back to you. It's just it. Comes back to you, but that means that if you start saying new things and do new things, saying better things and do better things, then your karma improves. So you and I have a conflict. That doesn't mean you are wrong and I am right. It only means our karma is bad. Let us sit down and talk it over. But then the Buddhists add one point, because that sounds almost like that American college guy. And they add a very important point. Before you do that, before you have that dialogue between the two of you, have an inner dialogue with yourself. Now, the inner dialogue is actually my expression for it. The Buddhists usually call it meditation. You examine your own assumptions. You go into yourself. And you do a thorough job. Try to clean up your own motives. And you try to find out, I would say, how do I think about conflict? What's my conflict philosophy? Now, what's my goal? For instance, if I launch myself as a mediator, and my goal is to get a Nobel Peace Prize, get out. Don't do it. Have an inner dialogue with yourself first. So they have a totally different way of thinking about conflict. And there are many, many others.
In part one of our conversation, Johann Galtung talked about the collective subconscious and figures from the deep culture which drive a society. Here we continue with that theme and talk about where the deep culture manifests itself, especially in politics.
There are many sources, ancient history in one, religion is one. Language, the way the language is structured is one, but there are very many sources. The way your food is organized is one.
The way it's produced or...
No, I'm more thinking of the way it is served. Let's take that as an example to get started. Let us say that you enter a restaurant. And you say, I would like to have salad, a main course, I would like to have a soup, and I would like to have dessert. However, I would like to start with the dessert, then I take the salad, then I take the main course, and then I take the soup. Now, that might work out in an American cafeteria. Try that in a French restaurant. He'll call for an ambulance, because these things have a certain time order to them. So, in the way food is served, you have learned your taught linear time. Things have a time ordered. In China, meals are much more flexible. And you can almost start in any way you will. Eat them any way you will. Now, that has great implications for the way they do politics. So they might, for instance, irritate the Russians by saying that we don't accept this thing about slavery, feudalism, capitalism, socialism, communism. We might start with some communism today and then still have some elements of capitalism and some feudalism and some slavery for that matter and some socialism. Now for the Russians, as good Occidentals, that was heresy. It has to be in that order. Needless to say, this makes the Orientals much more flexible. They see many more possibilities than we see because of our linearity of thinking. But let me take another point, very typical of the Occident, is the idea from Prince Manus in Iran. The idea of dividing things in two, the good and the bad. It's not only that it's two, but it's also good and bad. Now, we find it in the U.S. party system. The almost impossibility of the U.S. to admit and accommodate a third party. Now, there was an effort in last election. We'll see. It was a heroic effort, and many Americans learned to count to three just for that reason, that there was a third candidate. But by and large, the adversarial principle from jurisprudence, pro et contra, for and against, and with the plus and minus attached to it, you can say almost a car battery, if you will, being a metaphor for it, is projected onto a political situation, let us say Yugoslavia. So the two tasks you have to do immediately. The first one is, how can we divide all this into two? And second, who is the bad one, who is the good one? So, now, in Yugoslavia, at least 15 factions, but let us reduce it to three. Let us say just Serbs, Croats, and Muslims. So if you now divide it into two, there are three ways of doing that. And so that's where the mathematics enters. If you want them to be non-empty, the mathematician would add immediately, because you could also have three against zero. The way it was done was by first appointing the one who was guilty. And that was by definition the Serbs. There was just no doubt about it. Now, since there are by definition two parties, that means that both the Muslims and the Croats are good. But since good seeks good, that means the logical thing for them would be to have an alliance against evil. I would see that as totally, completely crazy when it comes to the reality of Yugoslavia. Absolutely, that alliance won't last at all. It has no chance. You just go to Bosnia-Herzegovina and talk with the Croats in the villages where the Muslims have been raping and killing, and talk with the Muslims in the villages where the Croats have been raping and killing. And you'll see immediately this is just engineered from the top. It's just a projection of a myth. But that myth is stronger than reality. And it runs away with many people.
And this reality, as you see it, is also reflected in the media.
No, the media are the carriers of it above all, who are the carriers of those myths and those precognitions without any reflection. Now, they are totally right in saying that there's no censorship. There's no little man sitting in the office next to the editor saying you should write like that, because it's completely unnecessary. The little man sits inside their brain, and he sits inside the brain of every single one of them, and has taught them that this is the way to think. I could take a ridiculously simple example. I could say at the University of Hawaii, where I'm teaching a little bit, one guy was running to become president of the student union. Now, what was the propaganda for him? The propaganda was that he could see both sides of an issue. Now, both. Now you have two again. Now, who says there are only two sides to an issue? It could be 15, for instance.
That's not a common thought.
Well, that's the point I'm making. Mm. The common thought is that there are two sides to an issue. And I'm quite willing to admit that it's better to see two sides than one side. I'm just saying that two can also become a prison, a mental prison.
Listening to Common Ground. It's a program on world affairs sponsored by the Stanley Foundation. My guest today is Johan Galtung, currently a professor of peace studies at the University of Hawaii and at the University of Wittenherdecke in Germany. Dr. Galtung founded the International Peace Research Institute in Norway and has received numerous international awards for his professional work and public service, including the Right to Livelihood Award. The Stanley Foundation is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that works to promote thought and dialogue about the world. Tapes and transcripts of Common Ground programs are available. Listen at the end of the broadcast for details on ordering. So how do we go about changing this bipolarity of thinking?
Well, that'll take a couple of hundred years in this country, I would imagine. And I don't think it's easy. But one could go about it in elementary school by taking lots of examples. For instance, you could start teaching the history of the Cold War. Instead of all the time talking about East against West, you could say East-West are non-aligned. Now, these were three groups. And they were trying to promote their own interests at the expense of the others. And the one that lost, there were two that lost. Not only the East, but also the non-aligned. Both of them are losers.
I think you'd have a hard time selling that to a lot of school systems.
I know. But I know one place where I have no difficulty selling that. That's in East Asia. Because East Asia is influenced by Taoist and Buddhist thought, but all of this I'm saying now is absolutely elementary. And that's a major reason why they become so powerful. Because they see many more possibilities.
And yet, why in East Asia, where you say, you know, the people are able to see many different ways, do you find such authoritarian regimes? They're so common there.
But they're not necessarily authoritarian in the same sense as ours are. There are other aspects to it than what I said. It is very vertical and very collectivist. So the family structure with a strong father on the top becomes, in a sense, a metaphor, a model for the whole society. I find that problematic. I don't like that in East Asia. So that's another aspect of it. It can also be argued that, but look, if that is the case, what you say, why was China so weak until recently? And I could answer, have a look at Chinese history. That was a down period. And on top of that, they were knocked out by the more or less colonial penetration by Britain, US, Germany, France, and as a matter of fact also India. They were that weak. 1st of October 1949 in Tiananmen Square, Mao Zedong put an end to that. And he's still celebrated for that. Incidentally, one reason why it was so important for the US press to soil the memory of Tiananmen Square by locating a massacre at that place, which, as far as I can understand, never took place.
On Tiananmen Square?
Took place other places, and was much worse than the US press discovered. Much, much worse. They made a double mistake, or a triple mistake. First of all, to think that it was against students. It was against workers. Workers who wanted a free trade union. Secondly, they put it in the wrong place. It was 6 kilometers away, Chang'an Avenue, where the roads go up to the universities. That was against the 36 students. Most of them were killed there. And thirdly, by underestimating the terrible violence against workers. I have heard numbers like 10,000 being executed. Hands tied behind the back, and a gun to the head, to the neck.
Why was it the students, then, who were memorialized in the minds of Americans? Was it youth? What students represent symbolically?
I think essentially because they were standing for what you could call bourgeois values. These are values I love, freedom of expression, for instance. They wrote their slogans in English, and they knew how to appear at a time for the networks. And they even made a goddess of liberty or freedom that to the Americans became an icon, something sacred. In other words, they knew how to behave. Now, these workers were arguing free trade union, more power to the workers, better salaries, better living conditions. They were arguing exactly the same as the workers in West Virginia were arguing that summer, if I'm not too wrong. Now, that was problematic for the U.S. You can take on the students because these are values enshrined in the U.S. Declaration of Independence of 1776 and the Constitution, of course, 87. And these are things that all Americans love and cherish for good reasons, and the U.S. has played a major role. So in that regard, China was in the wake of the U.S., and the U.S. was ahead, and China could be welcomed. Now, if the demands of those workers had been accepted, it would be far, far beyond anything that U.S. would be willing to concede to workers today.
And yet you still see that in China, the image we have of China is one that suppresses the rights of people to speech.
Which is correct. I'm professor there, and I can just testify that's a correct image. But let me only give you an example of how deep it is. I'm professor at the university. Every second year I come there and give some courses. And I asked my colleagues about that. Now, how do you see democracy? And they told me unanimously, of course, you cannot let the uneducated vote. It's only for the educated people. And I said, you mean that? What do you mean by education? I said, particularly the university education, actually. That would be a fairly limited democracy. Now, it happens to be the same type of democracy that we had in many countries in Europe 200 years ago, although it was less education and more based on money. Namely, that you defined who are the ones who are entitled to have a meaning, and you make a cutoff point, and if you don't make it, you don't make it. You're not in it. Now, this was not a governmental position. This was a position by professors sitting with nobody listening, just speaking their open mind. So I'm just saying, don't believe this is only a question of a government.
That leads me to one of the topics that you lectured on. The discussion of China leads me to that, and that is human rights. And you recently made a speech called How Can We Make Human Rights Less Western? What is so Western about human rights?
Well, if I should say a simple formula, is that so far the concept of human rights has absorbed three excellent Western ideas, but has not been sensitive to ideas of other civilizations. And those three, in my view, absolutely basic Western ideas are, point one, that the human physical body is sacred and belongs to that person alone. Nobody has a right to beat it. Nobody has a right to torture it. You could almost talk about the privatization of the body. Number two, and just remember, during feudalism, it was obvious that the body of the serf belonged to the lord, and he could do anything he wanted. And during slavery in the United States, even worse. It was absolutely obvious to the slave owner that flogging was just the way you treat that property, like you might do something the same to the cattle. Or you might be threshing your corn. It's yours. You treat it that way because it's your property. Now, point two, the sacredness of the human mind. That the ideas that accumulate in the ego, to talk in Freudian terms, trying to be a sort of chairperson regulating the debate between id and superego, because between the drives of the body and the morality, the morals, the moral that comes from the outside. That ego is also private, it is yours. It belongs to you, and it is the one that nobody else has a right to interfere with. Hence the freedom not only of expression but also impression. That's terribly important. And number three, equal justice, regardless of whether you are rich or poor, color or skin, gender, age, and so on. On the age, we are not so quite good because children are not in it, really.
And they
have
much
to learn. Old people also tend to get out of it. Exactly. But by and large, I mean, these are three fantastic ideas. And I could say they can be used constructively. Just take the example of the sacredness of the body. You can use that human right to lash out against pollution. I mean, obviously pollution is an insult to the body. Sacredness of the human mind. You can use it to lash out against advertising, which obviously is a pollution of the mind. Now, you can make those cases. But then the question is, what comes from other civilizations? So, you can then go civilization by civilization. And if I should start with Buddhism, the sacredness of all life. Meaning, not only that it is more than human beings, it also includes non-human life. But also meaning that under no circumstances do you have the right to take it. In other words, non-violence as an absolute norm. Translated into the human rights, that would mean the right not only not to be killed, but also the right not to kill.
So we'd be vegetarians.
We would be vegetarians. We'd be vegetarians and we would be pacifists. Which, in my view, would not be that bad. So why is it that we haven't accepted that? I mean, morally speaking, it's a much deeper message than what we have offered. So the audacity of calling our human rights universal, that is exactly that. That is fairly audacious. You need a strong Western stomach to be able to take that one.
Is there a move to make them more universal in that way?
Yes. You find it all over the world as a reaction against Western human rights. But it often takes the unfortunate form of rejecting the Western human rights instead of promoting one's own. So I stand for both and. I stand for human rights as something that comes out of a dialogue de civilisation, a dialogue among the civilizations. But let me take other examples. what you find in almost all indigenous cultures, almost all of them, you find a very, very basic idea, which is oneness with nature. And that oneness with nature is totally against the subdivision of nature into small plots that can be owned by the subdivision of humanity into small plots called an individual. And each individual buys his little plot and puts up a fence and puts a number on it. Now, in the Human Rights Declaration, the right of private property is enshrined. It is also the right of property together with others. In other words, it doesn't have to be the individual alone. But what is not enshrined is the right to live in a society without property. So I would like to see both at the same time. And that's where I, of course, get into difficulties with my friend the lawyers, because they cannot take contradictions. So they would say, but Professor Galtung, do you believe in property or don't believe in property? And I say I believe in both, I believe in property and non-property. And I believe in the possibility of a person to choose whether he wants to live in a world run by private property or a world not run by it.
Back to that idea that a lot of our politics are run by these figures in our collective subconscious. How do we rid ourselves of these traumas in our collective subconscious that lead to these conflicts?
Oh, that's a long story. But I think in a sense you have to use the same basic idea as the psychoanalysts do. Anybody who has been through a psychoanalysis will know one technique that a psychoanalyst sometimes uses. He reads a little characterization of a person for you. Let us say he reads three of them. And then he says, which one do you think fits you best? And you pick one of them. And then you start discussing it. Now, you could do the same collectively. You could, so to speak, hold up a mirror for the people and say, do you recognize something in this one? You should pay attention to one point. Khrushchev and Gorbachev held up mirrors for the Soviet Union. And people who had been eulogizing themselves saw the ugliness. You still haven't come to that point in America. The point is, you see, that if you hold up that mirror, you come back to the psychoanalyst again. A good psychoanalyst would not only see the weeds in your mental garden, he would see the roses and the beautiful things too. And he would say, let's cultivate those roses more. Now, here we have a couple of weeds. Let's do something about it. Do you need them? Are you sure you need them? And so on. The ways of doing that.
Johan Galtung has been my guest on Common Ground. He's one of the founders of the field of peace research and known throughout the world for his work in conflict resolution. I'm Mary Gray Davidson. If you'd like to order a tape or transcript of this program with Johan Galtung, call toll-free 1-800-825-5746. Cassettes cost $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Transcripts are $5 each. This has been the second of a two-part series with Dr. Galtung, and you can buy one or both parts of the series. The two parts are available on cassette for $15.95. Our theme music was created by B.J. Lederman. Common Ground is produced and funded by the Stanley Foundation.